and welcome to the ASP podcast. The American Security Project is a non-partisan think tank looking into some of the big strategic national security issues facing us all. Today we are joined by Andrew Holland, our senior fellow here at ASP, specializing in energy and climate security. And we have a special guest, Lisa Friedman. Lisa is deputy editor of Climate Wire, Washington's leading source of news on climate change and energy policy. She covers international policy, including global climate change negotiations and the intersection between climate, international security, and development. Over her career, she's climbed the Himalayas with glaciologists, explored water security in Pakistan, and has seen flooded villages in Bangladesh. Her next trip will take her to the Marshall Islands to explore how small Pacific islands are threatened with rising sea levels and changing weather patterns. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you.
You've traveled widely over the past several years looking at the impacts of climate change. What stands out to you as the most obvious or dangerous effect?
Well, so first of all, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. This is fantastic and really flattering. I think one of the things that has stood out to me is not, you know, all the impacts of climate change on their own are all threatening. Rising sea levels, changes in precipitation patterns. But as I've been able to travel to various countries to report on climate change, what stands out to me is the way climate change intersects with other things, things that are man-made, things that, massive urbanization. What does climate change mean when you have more and more people flooding into cities and slums are multiplying? What climate change means when you've got ethnic conflicts between communities and floods and other threats are exacerbating tensions. So to me, I think that's what stands out as, you know, that folks like the American Security Project and others call it a threat multiplier, and that's really what I see as I travel.
And Andrew, you wrote on this recently.
Yeah, you know, I was just about to ask whether you think that the threat multiplier term is an apt term, because, you know, we use it and say that climate change isn't going to cause conflict on its own, but it's going to affect things like water security, food security, energy, migration, and that in turn affects these urbanization patterns, these other patterns, and then that affects that affects conflict. So, you know, this is something that we've latched onto, the intelligence community has latched onto. Do you think that works?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm not an expert in these things. Mm-hmm. I rely on smart folks like yourself who study these. But you know, what I can offer are things that I've seen and reported on in various communities, and I think it's absolutely accurate. I think that, you know, what most communities, in fact, are focused on are not climate change or the threats of climate change, but rather whether they're able to get clean water, whether they're able to get access to electricity, whether they're safe in their communities, and whether they can, you know, have enough food. And and the way that climate change interacts on those things maybe isn't the top priority that I see in a lot of communities on the ground, but there's no doubt that those changes are already happening. And
what we see from globalization is that small effects in villages in the middle of Africa can have implications for U.S. national security. Mm-hmm. And how the DOD and how the State Department and USAID cope with this instability.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you see the debate on climate change around the world? Is it very different from what you see here in the U.S. and in Washington, D.C.?
Well, this is timely because negotiators are meeting right now in Bonn, Germany, for one of their mid-year negotiating sessions. The UN Climate Conference will be in Warsaw at the end of this year, and what they're working towards is, supposedly, a new global deal, a Copenhagen do-over. let's call it, by 2015. And what parties are hoping this looks like is something where all countries commit to reducing carbon emissions. What the debate looks like in various countries, I think, depends on their circumstances on the ground. I mean, just how, as we have our internal debate in the U.S., Europe is having its own fight. Developing countries are, you know, very concerned about what climate change means for them. The emerging powers among those, China, India, Brazil, are equally concerned about what cutting carbon or peaking would mean for their economic growth.
And what's happening in southern Germany right now with the mass floods, I mean, that's going to add impetus to
sure.
these talks. Now, so you were recently in Pakistan, which we've seen over the last few years has almost been sort of a key country for climate change and this nexus between climate change and security. The way the scientists are talking and what they've suggested is that Pakistan is going to be even worse.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of interesting things about Pakistan. So just as an aside, I wasn't there. I was there on a journalism fellowship. We weren't focused specifically on climate change, although I was able to do a number of side interviews and reporting on climate change. And a couple interesting things. One is that, you know, Pakistan's profile internationally in the climate change debate is actually pretty significant. They mm-hmm. brought a debate before the National Security Council at the UN. Their negotiators at the UN climate talks are, you know, take the lead on any number of issues. Domestically, though, you know, this is a country that is facing terrorism, sectarian violence. They can't, you know, they can't bring basic electricity services to their people. When we were there, every single meeting we had, the lights went out for, you know, until the generators went on. The government at the moment is reduced to telling civil servants to beat the power crisis by not wearing socks and keeping cool. So it's struggling to provide basic services to people. At the same time, it's dealing with a war on terror. And as threatened as Pakistan is, and it is among the most threatened countries in the world on any number of fronts, there's real questions about how well they're going to be able to meet these challenges given the immediate needs that their country faces.
So it ends up being the acute crises that pop up, you know, whether it's the Indus River floods of 2010 or, you know, future droughts or stuff like that end up being the ones that can be overwhelming to all these other problems. And because these other problems are there, you can't plan in the long term to be able to alleviate these acute when they come up.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I was at the Ministry of Climate Change in Pakistan, they told me that, you know, when they suffered these intense floods in 2010, the first ones on the scene, even before the government, were radical Islamic groups who were able to provide aid and tents, even before the government was able to get there. And so I think things like that underscore, you know, also the security importance of countries getting ahead on disaster management.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, we had a Bangladeshi general in a few weeks ago who was talking about the potential impacts of climate change on Bangladesh.
Right. Yeah, General Munir was in talking about that. And of course, the subcontinent, the rivers all are interrelated, all are interconnected, and they all start up in the Himalayas. And so Pakistan is very interesting in that, you know, it's almost entirely dependent on the Indus River, which starts in its arch rival, India. India controls the headwaters to the six rivers that flow into the Indus. And under the Indus Water Treaty, which is actually one of the great examples of a water treaty cooperating, working throughout even throughout wars, it's never been abridged. The major shooting wars, India has never abridged the Indus Water Treaty. So it's kind of this very interesting creature of, you know, some people talk a lot about water wars and you know, in the future we're going to fight over water as we, you know, one day fought over oil or something. But it's hard to see the evidence for that when you look at this. It's an interesting thing.
And you know, we see this week about Egypt and what had and its issue with Ethiopia.
Yeah.
And the building of the big dams over there. And we have some members of parliament from Egypt calling for Egypt to bomb.
That's right. You know, and it's an interesting sort of thing. You have these kind of basin hegemon arrangements, but when balances of power change, Egypt is in a low point of its power, and Ethiopia apparently thinks that it's rising, so it's challenging that. So it's an interesting sort of thing, whether it moves from being threats and talk to something that's actually, you know.
I mean, but even threats and talk need to be stabilized.
That's right.
Because there are third, fourth order effects
that
could affect the security of the U.S.
Yeah.
Just to bounce back to India and Pakistan for a moment, and this is a little bit of an old story by now, but it still rings true. I mean, one of the things that keeps coming up when I report on water management issues between India and Pakistan, success of Indus River Treaty aside, and mm-hmm. most certainly has been a basic inability to get visas to go for scientists to go to one another's countries to work on these issues. I mean, I've at the tail end of our trek to in the Himalayas, there was a meeting at Isimad, there was a mountain glacial meeting in Kathmandu, and a lot of the scientists who are there from India and Pakistan say that they see each other more in places like Nepal and Dubai than they ever do in each other's countries because they just can't get access to meet.
And you know, there's actually very good examples of where U.S. and Iranian scientists meet about things. non-nuclear issues, obviously, but that still happens. And so there's need for greater cooperation in the subcontinent. And we've talked before about the power issue in Pakistan
mm-hmm.
And the need to bring in power from Central Asia.
From Central Asia. And you know, you have this, it was a big part of the election over there was the Iranian gas pipeline coming in and, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, they need more energy, sure, but they also need to better manage their energy. They need to, you know, have actual prices and actually, you know, get a way for energy companies to make money selling people power. You know, there's a lot of dysfunction in there that it's not necessarily going to be solved by just massive infrastructure projects.
Yeah, we see that all over the world.
Yeah.
It's actually the economy.
Yeah.
But now, moving on from Pakistan, you're going to the Marshall Islands. Where are they in the Pacific?
They're in the South Pacific, and they are. It's a country that is both deeply threatened by climate change, but also interestingly, on the forefront of some really fascinating legal analysis about the impacts of climate change. The Marshall Islands teamed up with a Columbia University professor a couple years ago to start looking at legal issues like if an island sinks into the ocean, does it still get a seat at the UN? Fishing rights and shipping rights. So this is what's happening in the Marshall Islands is in September is the Pacific Island Forum, which is biannual, but you might need to correct me.
Yeah.
A major conference, and the minister and assistant to the president, whom I interviewed a couple months ago when he was here in Washington, said that they are going to be focused at this, you know, almost 100% on climate change. They're trying to get John Kerry to come. There's been a big lobbying pressure on Kerry from the Pacific Islands to see him there. Hillary Clinton came a couple of years ago to the one in the Cook Islands. And they're hoping that these islands, which are often described as the canary in the coal mine of climate change, can be the sort of moral voice that forces major polluters to set up, take notice, and do more to reduce emissions.
And it's not only the issue there is not only sort of land disappearing, it is the general security of the Pacific and what is going to go on.
Exactly.
When islands disappear, who owns the mineral rights?
Exactly.
And what we see right now is there are countries in the Pacific who are claiming territory that...
In the Arctic.
And as technology is advancing for undersea drilling and deep seabed mining and all that sort of stuff, there's an actual economic advantage to be gained from a lot of this sort of stuff. And fishing, the most low-tech sort of thing out there. But, you know, fishing rights, major
Absolutely.
Trawlers and everything, is a big, big deal.
Well, back in the 1970s, the United Kingdom had a war with Iceland, the Cod War. But with the U.S. pivot to Asia and DOD getting more interested in the shipping lanes and keeping free trade open, this is going to have major military effects
sure.
on the United States.
Sure, sure. I mean, and we've been actively engaged with all these countries since before World War II. You know, the island hopping campaigns of World War II and that sort of stuff were the last time a lot of Americans thought about this area.
Yes.
But it is important, and you know, we have a long relationship with them. Interestingly, and I'll be interested to read your stories to see what, if anything, the Chinese are doing there and that.
I think that's a good question. That's
picture.
Part of what we're going to be reporting on. And the other half of this is that we've been looking at islands more broadly, looking at the different threats that are facing islands, but also the different challenges that islands face in adapting to climate change. And to me, one of the really interesting stories is energy development. All over the world, you're seeing islands that are, you know, near entirely dependent on importing fossil fuels, really trying to make changes. Some countries starting on plans to wean off of fossil fuels, not an easy thing to do, different renewable energy targets. And then you have a country sort of unlike all the others, which is Haiti, where I was in February, that is, you know, both recovering from this devastating earthquake 3 years ago, and also they have this really sort of whiz-bang new energy minister who is really trying to figure out how this country with 85% energy poverty can develop access for parts of the country that have never seen it before.
Yeah. You know, it can be seen as an opportunity.
It can. And there's people like Jigar Shah who, with you know, in the case of Haiti specifically, you know, have said, look, you can run this country entirely on solar. That actually doesn't sit well with with some policymakers in Haiti who say, you know, that might not really work for us domestically.
Yeah.
But there are folks who are, you know, helping Haiti and other countries create roadmaps. And yes, in the case of Haiti, the fact that there is no grid for most of the country in some ways is an opportunity to start on a cleaner trajectory.
Lisa, this has been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
We've a quick tour of the world, but there are some
travels and climate change.
Yeah, I mean, there's some major issues for the world and the U.S. national security here. Well, good luck in the Marshall Islands. We're going to be reading your stuff with interest, and when you're back, please come back.
This was so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.